Twyla Tharp is one of our most celebrated choreographers. Over the course of her long career, she has worked in many mediums with a breathtaking variety of collaborators: Milos Forman, Mikhail Baryshnikov, David Byrne, Bob Dylan, Billy Joel. And she's managed to incorporate her own vision into some of our most beloved and familiar music. Besides her work as a choreographer, she's written two best-selling books. Her latest, The Collaborative Habit, is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it has brought her back to our show. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you so much.
Is choreography unique in terms of the level and complexity of collaboration that it requires?
I believe that it is, due to the fact that all other art forms have an intermediary stage between the thinking process and the realization of it. For example, a composer has a score, which the musician then puts into effect, text, so on and so forth. The choreographer works directly with other individuals.
It's like writing a play where you're saying, hey, how about you saying,
exactly,
how are you this morning?
Exactly, and that has been done. Sam Shepard used to work that way.
And Mike Lee to some degree. And then once they have worked it out, they write it down.
They do, we don't.
In every collaboration, does someone have to function as the boss?
It's best that way.
So in the end, I'm assuming great artistic achievements are the realization of a single vision, and then you have to decide the collaboration whether you share a single vision or whose single vision is going to wind up being the one that wins out.
Yeah, no, I'm being glib about the boss part. In a successful collaboration, you have two items that are key. One, you have got to have respect. You have genuinely got to have respect for your collaborator. And two, you have to have a bottom line, a common purpose that is completely shared and committed to. And from that point on, if the collaboration is successful, nobody is the boss. Everybody is working towards this goal and doing what each of the collaborators does best, and leave them alone.
On the other hand, there's usually somebody whose name is on the top. You talk about Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel. He had how many apprentices working for
numbers
him?
Numbers, who knows.
And throughout much of the history of the Renaissance and into Rubens.
That's a mentoring apprenticeship kind of situation. That's not really a collaboration.
Well, Rubens had all of these famous painters working for him, and they all, one
true.
Took the animals, one
did
took
the hands,
furs.
And one did the ears of the young people, and one did the ears of the older people because they would be larger and type thing. But in all seriousness, those were factories, and he was the factory boss. But that's not really what I talk about in relation to collaboration, where you have two forces that are equally powerful and committed, and who are not, who don't duplicate one another's areas. In a painter's atelier, you have everybody is painting. That's many cooks in one kitchen. What I'm describing is people of different occupations and different kinds of areas of expertise who bring this together to create this hybrid.
Well, there's a difference when you are doing the choreography for your company and people have signed on and agreed to share your vision and do whatever you ask them to do, sometimes things that seem impossible. But then when you work on a Broadway show, you're working with a whole bunch of other people who also are used to being in charge.
Yes. In all fairness to those I work with in my own company, I ask them to do what they do. I don't ask them to do what I do any longer as a dancer. That would be rather foolish. So, in effect, I am working with them as individuals. Obviously, in a Broadway show, there are many departments. You have scenics, you have lights, you have publicity, you have, across the boards, components to be integrated.
Well, let me back up. So when you have a dancer and you know this dancer can leap really high, then you're going to ask that dancer to leap high and not the other dancer.
Or I might ask him not to leap at all.
Uh-huh.
And see where that got us, because chances are no one ever approached it that way. And that could generate some interesting tension, and then we'd have them jump. But you know what I'm saying.
But in the case of a Broadway show, there are any number of people involved in the creative input, the director, the writer, and the choreographer. And I wonder if that's a reason that Susan Stroman now directs as well as choreographs.
Well, I direct, write, choreograph, and essentially in the early stages of the thing, produce the shows. So from that point of view, it's not like the old days where Jerry was doing the choreography and Bernstein was doing the music and Sondheim was doing the lyrics and, you know,
That was a division of powers.
That was a nightmare.
And was there a power struggle in
those days? Terrible. But it generated great material. I mean, I think Gypsy is a fantastic accomplishment. West Side Story, those shows. But those probably will not come to pass in that way any longer. Those guys all knew each other really well. I mean, they were a collective.
In the movies, we had people like Hermes Pan,
right,
who just directed the dance sequences.
Hermes
Pan. Or Busby Berkeley.
Well, Hermes Pan is a very interesting figure because Hermes Pan made possible Astaire Rogers. Without Hermes Pan, those great musical duets would never have come to pass because Astaire really couldn't rehearse with Rogers. He rehearsed with Hermes Pan and then got on the set and they assembled and put it together. But it was done with this intermediary. So in effect,
why was that? Was Ginger Rogers resistant to?
No, Ginger Rogers.
Out with
no,
Fred Astaire?
She didn't have the chops that Astaire had. She was not the trained, disciplined dancer that he was. Hermes Pan had a better grip on that kind of working ethos, and Astaire was a perfectionist. He had no patience for someone who didn't know how to work as intensely as he did. And from that point of view, he was really quite a terrible collaborator, bless his heart.
It's interesting that Debbie Reynolds tells a story of bursting into tears when
Gene Kelly
was upset with her because she just was not up to the dance numbers and Singing in the Rain. And this very nice man helped her get through, and that was Fred Astaire. So he could sympathize with others. He just couldn't do it for himself.
No. It would be different if he were in front of the camera than not.
Mm-hmm. Twyla Tharp's latest book. And is it weird to hear that? Your
what?
Latest book?
Why would it?
Well, no,
be?
because we tend to think of choreographers as people who do choreography, and maybe they write a book. But this is what, your third or fourth?
Third, unless you count one other one. But the third, others have written. Agnes DeMille was a very good writer. Mm-hmm. Martha Graham wrote several books. Doris Humphrey wrote a book. So it's unfair to think of choreographers as being nonverbal people.
Twyla Tharp, a very verbal person, has her latest book is The Collaborative Habit, Life Lessons for Working Together. And it is published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I am Leonard Lopate. How does one become a choreographer in the first place? There are a lot of dancers, but not all of them become choreographers.
In this book, The Collaborative Habit, talk about actually how that came to pass. I had twin brothers who were 4 years younger than I, and when I was a kid of about 12, I had been given lots of lessons, tap dancing, baton twirling, a little ballet, some gymnastics, and I was assigned the chore of passing these lessons on to the siblings. So I realized when I was teaching these boys who were identical twins, my parents couldn't tell them apart. They were Stanley and Stanford, and they were both called Stan. Nobody was taking any chances here. So when I was teaching them their lessons and I stood back and looked at them, I realized that Stan liked better to turn and that one couldn't turn to the left. It was a right-handed one. And how interesting was this? Because I learned to tell them apart through the way they moved. I learned their identities through their movements. And I think that's when I became a choreographer. I learned that I could read more about human psyche, personality, hopes, fears, loves, desires, etc., through choreography than any other way.
And you also being given musical training.
I had, yes, Ben.
So that it's the two. It's the, because choreography is about working with music, but it's also doing something very visual.
Yes.
Also understanding how bodies work, I assume.
It is. And in the case of the twins, they were they had developed a language, which a large percentage of twins actually do, because they were in a nursery so much of the time together that their native tongue was Italia, not English. And my parents could not understand this. And a large part of this coded language that they spoke was movement and gesture. And I was the translator. I could tell it apart, and even when I couldn't, I made it up, and sometimes not to their advantage, but in any case, I was the family translator. The point here being that as a kid, I saw language and movement being interchangeable as a way of communication.
Did the fact that your family ran a drive-in theater play a role in...
Huge, because in a drive-in theater, you're parked in a car, and you can take the speaker out, and you are watching the movie silently. And you see action, and you learn that you really don't need sound.
But what happens when you hear sound? When you're listening to a piece of music, do you immediately start seeing things that you would want to do with that music?
I can if I'm being very indulgent, because that means I've probably seen them before.
Uh-huh.
Better is the music that suggests I don't know what I'm seeing here, but I sort of feel this, and you get in and you start to work with it, and then it solidifies, and then you pull back, or then I pull back, and I say, oh, yeah, now I see better what it is here. Every now and again, I'll allow myself the indulgence of putting up what I see. I'm never happy.
Well, since you're also a dancer and somebody who says you are happiest when you're dancing, how does that apply here? Because you're working with other people, as you said.
I share the burden. I do a lot of work myself still before going into rehearsals with other people. So I always have fallback material, and I also have material that I can use as a standard, which I expect to use interchangeably. It's not specialized white elephant kind of movement that only a great dancer is ever going to be able to do really well. It's something that can be approached by many different kinds of trainings and many different kinds of physical body types, but I evolved that myself.
You talked about figuring out which one of your brothers was which by watching their body movement, and you've said that you don't think anybody should be a politician who's not comfortable with his physical self.
I really don't, because...
Well, George Bush was comfortable with his physical self, and I think Barack Obama seems to be as well.
He seems to be, yes.
So maybe they both should have been politicians.
Okay.
I don't know where your politics lie, I can guess. But what is the point well taken there? Or?
I think so for two reasons. I think that if one exercises, operates the body, has the blood flowing, expects the body to function, the mind works better. It's easy. It's also a muscle. That's item number one. Item number two, if you invest time working your body, you appreciate the physical nature of us all, and you're not so very anxious to see bodies destroyed. I'm not saying anyone is anxious to see bodies destroyed, but I'm saying that there is a sympathy and a connection between those who do utilize their bodies and those who are sent out to do labor and chores.
When you were at Barnard, you studied with three great dancers, Martha Graham, Merce Cunningham, Paul Taylor, all with very different aesthetics.
Yes.
So was your relationship to them different?
Yes, because I saw each of them, or tried to see each of them, or certainly felt each of them for what they were and how they could move, how they approached movement, how they thought about dance. And I was extraordinarily fortunate to be able to work directly, in a room with these folks.
Although you didn't dance in all of their companies.
No. I danced only with Paul for a very brief period of time, but it was not my intention ultimately to be a professional dancer. I saw different ways of making my quest than through realizing the vision. I think part of it for me was seeing these three really masters at work simultaneously and realizing that there were three very different ways of doing the job, and maybe I could come up with one.
And when you formed your initial company, it was an all-female company.
Right.
I'm assuming that you did that on purpose.
I did. I sometimes say it was by accident, but you're right. It was a choice.
A political choice, or was it a matter of just feeling that you'd be more comfortable working with women?
It's because I had a sense, first of all, women working with women work differently. Second of all, there is a kind of purity that can be invested. For example, mixed doubles in tennis is a totally different deal. It can be very interesting, but it doesn't have the same edge to it as two men directly in combat. And there's a purity about women, and I wanted us to do what women could do. And when it came to the jumping, for example, if you said we wanted to jump, we didn't want to suddenly go men jump higher. Well, yeah, but let's see what we can do in all this area. Plus the privilege of working interchangeably, which is something women do extremely well, the kind of efficiency of the team work is a great privilege.
Well, the conventional wisdom is that women collaborate more readily with each other than men do, that there's less of a competition in most cases.
Yeah, that's true. You can beat it down. It takes time.
On the other hand, it's hard to do a really good pas de deux.
It is. It can be done, but yes, it is. I am privileged to work with some great dancers I've been working with for quite a while, and in the cast of a new show, which will be going up this spring, I do have a phenomenal group of dancers who work brilliantly together.
Well, Balanchine thought that the main job of a man was to lift the beautiful woman dancer.
He and I see men and women differently.
So when you finally started working with men, had you worked out what you wanted from them?
No, I was pretty much, what I had worked out was what my capacities were. I had a pretty strong sense and a great security in my own capacity and in my independence as a mover. So I was not threatened by the men. I was interested now, after 5 years working just with the women, what men could do. I knew what women could do.
There were economic factors as well, weren't there, in the decision to only work with women?
Well, that's what I say.
But is that true?
Sort of. In the mid-60s, when I was starting my company, there were not a lot of really strong male performers, and they were at a premium for companies that could pay, which we could not. But that wasn't really it. Really, it was about where I saw the challenge.
And then later, when you became a celebrated choreographer, male dancers came to you. Baryshnikov came to you. I'm sure you were in a very different situation then, felt you were in a stronger situation than you might have been if you just started off with your usual company.
Yes, that is so.
Twyla Tharp, her latest book, The Collaborative Habit, Life Lessons for Working Together. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
We're back with Twyla Tharp, her latest book, The Collaborative Habit, Life Lessons for Working Together, published by Simon & Schuster. When you created your first dances to Frank Sinatra's music, you weren't collaborating with Frank Sinatra in the usual sense. Were you? It was more like creating a piece for Bach or something John Cage was doing for Merce Cunningham.
Yes and no. But before that, I was actually, when the Beach Boys song came on, Wouldn't It Be Nice, was in Deuce Coupe. And Deuce Coupe was the first of these adventures where I used popular music in a dance work. And it was a collaboration, really my first large collaboration, because it was one of the first time that we worked with men. My modern company was working with a ballet company. We had popular music being being played for a ballet audience, and it all seemed to get along swimmingly. We had graffiti kids. The kids who were painting the subways, the first generation, did the backdrop for the thing in real time as it was going on. So many, many, many components here collaborating. When it came time for Sinatra, the show that goes up this spring will be my fourth pass at Sinatra, and it's a very special kind of collaboration. It's in a way it's within the family. I didn't know Sinatra when I did it, the first one, which was a duet that Brishnikoff and I did at the Met, and I think that we thought we could get Sinatra to sing. We didn't. After that, the next one was 9 Sinatra songs, and Frank did come to see that, we had adventures, and he liked it very much. Shortly after that, I did one called Sinatra Suite, which was an excerpt from 9 Sinatra songs and a repositing of One More for My Baby, which had been a duet in 9 Sinatra songs, but I remade it as a solo for Misha, in which I gave him this sort of Frank character at 3 o'clock in the morning in a bar carrying on. And Sinatra liked this one enormously and asked that we dance it at the Kennedy Center when he was given the honors. So we spent a bit of time with him there. So now as I make this fourth pass at the thing, it's revisiting in a way, as I said, a sort of dynasty. It's like the Greek dynasties at work. And I also look at it as Proust and going back finally through the library one last time to see the community. And the interesting
And this
thing,
will be show length?
Yeah, it's a Broadway show. It's going up. It has actually 3 of the original duets in it, but the rest, 32 songs or whatever, are all a new evening for me and for 4 couples. And it looks at these couples who might have been in 9 Sinatra songs, but 25 years later, and says, who are they? What happened? And the thing about dancers that is different than Proust characters is dancers don't age. So in going back, you see the essence of Sarah, but you don't really see the old Sarah. You see the essence of Sarah in the recasting of one of those roles, or the essence of Misha in the recasting of one of those roles.
But everybody is going to be different. Nobody's going to dance exactly like Baryshnikov danced.
No.
You could get a great dancer, but it will still be different.
It's the question of essence, which was Proust's question. It's the question of truth. What is the truth? Wherein does it lie as time passes by?
It was after Deuce Coupe that Baryshnikov sought you out, and that's how you wound up collaborating. Were you concerned at all that he was, at that point, the darling of the dance world?
Very concerned. Very concerned, very scary. I ran into Alvin Ailey in an elevator. I didn't know Alvin well, but he was a very, very sweet man. And he said, oh, my God, are you really going to do that? Are you nuts? And I said, yeah, probably, but I am.
You decided that you needed to see Baryshnikov rehearse before you agreed to collaborate with him.
Yeah, because I had to know if there was an interface, if we had enough in common where we would be able to communicate. What Alvin was really saying is, look, this guy is so overpowering, you don't have a chance. And I'm going, well, yeah, that's probably true, but I sort of think that it's such a wonderful opportunity that I ought to pursue it, at least to the point of realizing I have nothing to say. And in watching Misha rehearse, I felt I did have something to say.
And he also is somebody who obviously wants to work with other people. That's part of the pleasure of dance for him, or as an actor, in fact, and maybe it helps that he is such a good actor. You choreographed a dance for Gregory Hines and Baryshnikov in the movie White Nights. So you did a lot of stuff with Misha over the years.
Yes, there were a number of undertakings.
How do you deal with dancers like that? I mean, we're talking about dancers who come from such different places, and you're putting them together.
As I said, item number 1 from this book is respect, that Greg and Misha were obviously completely different dancers, but because they were both so very good, they had enormous regard for one another, and they loved to work together, and they were not a threat to each other. It's like a great boxer. You have a great boxer in a bar, and some guy comes in and starts to pick a fight. Do you think this boxer's going to go out and fight with this guy? No, he's just going to look at him like, are you nuts? And it was like this with these two guys who are equally great boxers. There's no fight.
Mm-hmm. And they both, you play them to their strengths.
I like to think so. No, I do, because
or,
I regard
as you said
them.
Earlier, if a guy leaps, you don't have him leap. So you have Misha do tap dancing, and you have Gregory Hines.
Not for very long, leaping. You don't. No, I wouldn't think so. They did that on their own when they were playing around in the corner, but only because you might see that, Misha's a tap dancer, doesn't get that. But look what he does understand that Greg has just learned to take for granted. I mean, I did a project once with Lynn Swan and Peter Martins, if one wants to talk about jumping, the ways in which each of them could instruct the other in jumping. I mean, Lynn's hang time was a lot more than Peter's was, but
really?
Peter's power of takeoff was different. So, it's live and learn. And bottom line, I'll just keep repeating it, respect.
My guest is Twyla Tharp. Her latest book, The Collaborative Habit, is published by Simon & Schuster. You write about the Japanese decision-making process called Ringi. What's that?
It's that everybody needs to assess what is required of the situation and how then can they feed into it from their own point of view. I feel that in collaboration, a lot of the time, people try to, try to accommodate me instead of looking to see what are their fortes, what are their strengths, and knowing their own identity and sticking with it in a collaboration. This is really important.
Now, it's one thing for you to have your own company. It's another thing for you to choreograph for another company. What happened when Robert Joffrey asked you to create a dance for his company? Did he want you to do something that would be a Joffrey-style dance?
Bob was a great company director, unique, and I love him dearly. He'd seen a piece called The Bix Pieces at the Delacorte, which had a formalized lecture demonstration in the center of it that pointed out the parallels between modern dance and the ballet. And he thought that, okay, here's somebody who maybe could write a ballet. So he came and said, would I? And I said, yeah, sure. I was 12 at the time. I said, I'll rewrite Swan Lake. He said, well, I think maybe let's just start with a one act, shall we? I said, oh, okay. So he gave me a handful of tickets, and I watched the company, which I'd never seen, for a season, and learned something about how the dancers danced and learned a great deal about how the audience looked, what they looked for, how they responded to. And then I wanted to find a way where I could utilize those strengths that he brought to the table and yet bring in something that I could offer in a singular fashion. So I wasn't just exploiting his resources.
Different choreographers have different ideas of how to deal with the music that they're working with. Some want to create steps that go directly with it. Mark Morris, for example. Others, like Merce Cunningham, didn't even put the music and the dance together until performance night. How do you connect music to what
you
do?
Across the boards, the first 5 years, I used no music at all. So I completely structured the work visually. I on occasion, the Beethoven, the Diabelli say, I will have memorized that score before I start to work. And sometimes I will respect the structure, but not the exact linear note for noteness of it, because I find that repetitive and a little redundant, excepting on occasion. I will go there as a kind of spice, but often I will take the structure of the music and build something that either parallels or purposely goes in opposition to.
Did people accuse you of
everything?
I don't want to use the word selling out, but you know what I mean. Did so many things with pop artists in a dance form that generally uses classical music.
I work only with music that I respect. I started my very first piece of music after the 5 years in the wilderness of silence was to the music of Jelly Roll Morton, who is one of our earliest great, American composers.
He claimed to be the inventor of jazz.
And bless his heart. I mean, Joplin might have had some issue with that, but
Louis
never
mind.
And Louis Armstrong. But I think that I don't judge by elite categories or popular categories. I judge by my gut response.
Whose idea was moving out?
Moving out. Which one is that? Moving out. Let's see. That was my.
Did you know Billy Joel at the time?
No, I did not. But my son said to me, "Mom, let's do Broadway." And I said, "Well, who do you want?" He said, "Well, Billy Joel's good." And I said, "I don't know Billy." And I said, "Well, never mind." So I got some of the gang together in the studio and put some of Billy's recordings on and did some video and did a little edit of it. And then I got his number. I called him up. I said, "You don't know me, but come here. I got something to show you." And he did. So in looking at the video, he was very, very pleased, and he said, "Okay, I'd like to do this. What do you want from me?" And I said, "All your music." And he said, "Okay, you got it." And I said, "I do."
That's easy.
Okay, yeah, it was that easy. And that's the way a really good collaboration works, is that easily.
Well, you were upset when some of your cast was coming to rehearsals on motorcycles.
I was very upset. I was upset in Chicago.
It could get hurt that way.
I was upset in Chicago when that happened, and I was upset in New York when that happened, and I was even more upset when I was in the hospital with William Marier, who turned the wrong direction on a motorcycle, skidded, and was dead the next morning.
Now, why do you think that the times they are a change in your Dylan piece didn't turn out to be as successful, at least commercially?
I wouldn't be able to really analyze that because what it was controversial. There were numbers of people, including Bob, who liked it very, very much. It was not a commercial success, I think, partially because it was not prepared for properly. In other words, in The Collaborative Habit at one point, there is a chapter about communicating with your audience. And I do think that it behooves everybody. We all invest too much in these things not to make it possible for people to enjoy and to enter into them. And that groundwork was not done for the Dylan, and people were left to come in to a show that had Bob Dylan's music expecting to see Bob Dylan. And that was not the show that I had done. It was not a biopic.
In these shows like Moving Out and The Times They Are Changing, you are using music that's already been recorded. But with Elvis Costello, he was going to write something for you?
Elvis did write something for us. He wrote for the Miami City Ballet a score called Night Spot.
But didn't he miss his first deadline?
He did.
So that has to be a problem.
It was, but we had a dummy track, and we continued onward to the second deadline.
But this is a collaboration by long distance.
It is.
And is that a problem? Would it be a lot easier if he were there and you could say, "Gee, I really like this. Let's pursue it along these lines"?
In The Collaborative Habit, there is a chapter about communications by long distance and through technology. And what ended up happening was that Elvis's performance schedule was brutal at the same time as he was dealing with writing a score. And he sent MP3s, and I'm using Final Cut programs, and we're editing back and forth on videotape and trying to sync cues, and we ended up doing a virtual ballet that then we attempted to transpose into real time and space on real dancers and real musicians, and in a way had passed beyond that pale. It became a different creature.
You mentioned the audience response. Is the audience a part of the collaboration?
As I said, with the Joffrey piece, it was the first time I'd done this, but there I really did take into account what the audience expected and did not always give them what they expected, but felt I had a handle on what they came in wanting.
Twyla Tharp will be signing books. The books we're talking about are The Collaborative Habit, Life Lessons for Working Together, published by Simon & Schuster. This Wednesday at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble store opposite Lincoln Center. That's at Broadway at 66th Street. And when does the show open?
Middle March.
And that'll be Frank Sinatra, the music of Frank Sinatra.
Correct.
Sung by Frank Sinatra.
Sung by Frank Sinatra. We have isolated the track. The band is live. The only thing that's recorded is Sinatra's voice.
Thank you so much, Twyla Tharp, for being with us again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. On tomorrow's show, CNN senior analyst and New Yorker staff writer Jeffrey Toobin discusses the trial of self-described 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Then Sue Grafton on her latest novel, You is for Undertow. Also food writer Nigella Lawson on a new collection of Christmas recipes. And Leslie Caron, talk about great dancers, reminisces on her acting and dancing career in the golden age of musicals at MGM. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Stephanie Bernhardt, Adam Delahanty, and Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.